Good morning.
Good morning.
How's everyone doing this morning? Okay, super. Glad to hear it. Kind of a nice day out there, warm again. We finally got our January thaw on the very last day of January. It was pretty nice. I was out in the driveway getting some of that packed snow up. It was pretty nice. It was an interesting January, for one thing. Something happened that doesn't happen very often. We had an inauguration in January, and that was pretty interesting. I know a lot of people took the day off and went to parties to watch it and things like that. It seemed like everyone was talking about it. I watched it at work. I work in a really large place, and there's a coffee shop where I work, and I thought I'd walk down there and see if anyone else was there watching the inauguration, because they have a couple of TVs down there. And I got down there, and by the time of the swearing-in, there were about 200 people down there. And just kind of watching and really focused, and people would applaud and things like that. And it was fun. And I think everyone has to admit, you know, regardless of your political beliefs, regardless of how you feel about the new president politically, and I'm not making any assumptions about that, that there's this real spirit of optimism right now, and there's this real sense of a new beginning, and it's kind of exciting. I found a little newspaper article. This was written just before the inauguration. It said, Obama will take office as the most popular incoming president in a generation. About 8 in 10 have a favorable view of him, and about 7 in 10 say he understands their problems and say his victory gives him a mandate to work for major new social and economic programs. So it's pretty strong, the spirit of optimism. It seems like there's been kind of a change in the attitude of the country, and I felt like this should be marked in some way. I wanted to talk about it. So what I got to thinking about was whether there is a Buddhist perspective on what leadership in the secular world should be like. And if so, what is it? And does it have anything to do with our practice? Can we learn anything from looking at this that might help us with our own day-to-day practice? Is there something about the Buddhist perspective, the way we see all things as being interrelated, that might contribute to this discussion? So I did some research, and I'd like to talk a little bit about these things. The first place I went to was What the Buddha Taught by Wapola Rahula. It's a good book I use a lot. It was written in 1959. Still good. He said that in the days of the Buddha, just as today, there were rulers who ruled their countries unjustly, and there was a lot of suffering, and the Buddha saw this, and he was really moved by people suffering, and he directed his attention to the problem of good government. Rahula says his views should be appreciated against the social, economic, and political background of the time, which is a good point because countries were led by kings in those days. That's how it was in India. So of course, those are the terms that he spoke in, and he set forth 10 duties of the king, which I will list for you. The first, a good king should have the characteristic, the quality of dana, generosity. He should not try to enrich himself. Second, high moral character. Third, a king should give up personal comfort. Fourth, honesty and integrity. Fifth, kindness and gentleness. He should possess a genial temperament. Sixth, austerity in habits. Seventh, freedom from hatred, ill will, and enmity. Eight, nonviolence. Not only avoiding violence, but also promoting peace, working actively to promote peace. Number nine, patience, forbearance, tolerance, and understanding. Number 10, non-opposition or non-obstruction. And what that means is not opposing the will of the people, ruling in harmony with the people, which is probably about the closest you can get to a democratic ideal within a system that has a king. And I think it's really interesting. I think every one of these still applies today, these qualities. These are things that we might look for in our leaders. A couple of other interesting things from Rahula. The Kuta Danta Sutra says that the best way to end crime is not punishment, but improving the economic conditions of the people. Also, the Buddha was dedicated to peace. I think one of the most moving and helpful parts of the Dhammapada is this little quote, "Never by hatred is hatred appeased, but hatred is appeased by kindness. This is the eternal truth." And this the Buddha lived by. There was an occasion where the Buddha went to a field of battle and intervened personally to stop a war between the Shakyas and the Kaliyas, who were prepared to fight over the waters of a river. And there was another instance where he prevented a king from attacking another kingdom. Also, there's the concept of the Chakravartin. Chakravartin, that's a Sanskrit word meaning wheel turner. And a wheel turner is a monarch or emperor whose rule is unbounded, as symbolized by the free movement of his chariot wheels throughout the land. It's also interpreted as meaning for whom the wheel of Dharma is turning. And this term Chakravartin is a very old term. It shows up in a lot of classical Hindu texts, and Buddhists adopted the term. They took it up. And it's kind of tied up with the idea of a universal ruler ruling vast lands. That part I don't find quite as interesting as the part where the ruler is really good at ruling. So it represents the Buddhist political idea of a just ruler who brings peace and prosperity to his subjects. We might say his or her. I'm going to say his a lot, probably, because this is dealing with kings, and in those days they were all male, of course. The term Chakravartin was also used for the Buddha, whose teachings pervaded all lands. So we might think of the Chakravartin as the secular counterpart of the Buddha, a person who brings well-being to everyone in the secular world as opposed to the spiritual world. And there are various monarchs throughout history who have been considered Chakravartins by various people. And the one who is mentioned most commonly is King Ashoka. And he's considered by many to really have been the best at bringing sort of Buddhist values into governing. And he ruled in India from around 272 to 231 BCE. And I'd like to talk about him in some detail. I think he's a really interesting guy. So I hope you like history, because I'm going to give you some details here. So I'm going to start by setting the scene for King Ashoka. The Buddha died. We have various dates for that, and we really don't know when it is, but a couple of dates are 486 and 410 BCE. Alexander the Great from Greece came as far as India. He conquered a lot of territory. He left Greece. He went all the way through Persia. He got all the way to India, conquering land, and he crossed the Indus River in 326. So this is maybe 100 years after the time of the Buddha that Alexander the Great shows up in India with his conquering army. And I'm going to throw in a little aside here just because I think it's really interesting, which is that the first representations of the Buddha, the first statues of the Buddha that people have found, were made by Greeks or people trained by Greeks in the Gandhara region in northwestern India. And they're really interesting. And in fact, you can see one of these if you go to the Art Institute. There's a statue from Gandhara, which is a representation of the Buddha, which looks very Greek. A lot of attention paid to the way the robes fall, kind of a stiff figure, kind of a little smile like they had on those statues, and a very Caucasian-looking face. Really interesting stuff. So Alexander turned back after he crossed the Indus, and he died a few years later in Babylon in 323, and he left another Greek heir to his empire. And a guy named Chandragupta, who was Ashoka's grandfather, was a brilliant opportunist, heard of the death of Alexander and moved in and conquered what remained of the Greek armies and set up his own kingdom. And the throne then passed to Ashoka's father, Bindisara. Between them, they conquered almost all of India, everything except the southern tip and a place called called Kalinga, which is near the what is now the western border of Bangladesh. So it was really a vast empire. It included what is now Bangladesh, what is now Pakistan, part of what is now Afghanistan. And so Ashoka inherited this vast kingdom. He became the ruler of his kingdom, 272 BCE. And although he would attain great fame as being a very kind person, he didn't start out as a nice guy. He came into contact with Buddhism early in his life, but he was too headstrong and violent to embrace it. And it is said, and no one knows if this is really true, there are varying accounts, but it is said that he murdered his brothers in order to attain the throne. Perhaps as many as 30 brothers. He had a lot of siblings because people had multiple lives in those days. We don't know about that, but we do know this has been verified historically, that he set out to conquer Kalinga, that remaining area over there by what is now Bangladesh. And by all accounts, there was really excessive bloodshed and destruction during this conquest. One source says he established a record of useless slaughter and cruel behavior hardly equaled by any other monarch in history. I don't know, that's pretty strong. But it's true that it caused a great deal of suffering, and it was remorse over this that led him to embrace Buddhism. And he issued an edict later, which he had carved into a rock for all the people to see, explaining what had happened. And he said in that edict, when the king had been on his throne, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, when the king had been on his throne 8 years, Kalinga was conquered. 150,000 people were deported, 100,000 were killed, and many times that number died. But after the conquest of Kalinga, the king began to follow Dharma, to love Dharma, and to give instructions in Dharma. Now the king regrets the conquest of Kalinga. And then he talks a great deal about all of the suffering of all the people who died and how there's kind of a ripple effect from that suffering which affects many, many other people. And he says that he's had this inscription of righteousness engraved so that his sons and grandsons may not seek to gain new victories. So he was very, very moved by these horrible things he had done. And he told everyone about it. And he came clean. And he said, it must never happen again. And he became a lay follower of Buddhism. And he started his reign of Dharma, he called it. He spent the rest of his life trying to make up for his outrageous conduct. And there was peace throughout the land. And I like this story because it shows us that no one is beyond redemption. And he was known for the quality of his governance. He renovated major roads. He built universities. He built irrigation systems. He had wells dug. He undertook journeys of inspection throughout the realm to make sure everything was going okay. He was mostly a pacifist. He propagated vegetarianism, and he forbade animal sacrifice. He abolished the royal hunt. He established hospitals for sick animals. I would assume hospitals for people, too, although I didn't find that. He planted trees. He says in one of his edicts, I have had banyan trees planted on the roads to give shade to man and beast. I have planted mango groves, and I have had ponds dug and shelters erected along the roads at every 8 kos, which is 16 miles or one day's journey. He maintained friendly relations with all neighboring states. He sent ambassadors to 5 Hellenic kingdoms all the way to Greece to tell them about Buddhism. And he kind of claimed that he converted the Greeks to Buddhism, but I don't think that's really true. One source says that the earliest mention of Buddhism in the West is the 2nd century AD, so he probably probably didn't have much impact, but it's kind of interesting. And there are some people who speculate that these Buddhist ideas had an impact on early Christianity. I don't know about that, but it's interesting to speculate about. And he also did a great deal to propagate Buddhism. He proved to be as passionate about his Buddhist faith, if you will, as he had been about conquering people before. He made Buddhism the court religion. He's said to have built 84,000 stupas and monasteries. He appointed officers known as superintendents of Dharma to propagate Buddhism, the Dharma Mahamatra. He sent missionaries to what's now Burma and Thailand, and he sent the first Buddhist missionaries to what is now Sri Lanka, in fact, his own son and daughter who were ordained. He called the Third Great Council to discuss Buddhism, and some of you who know a lot about Buddhist history know about the series of councils, the first one shortly after the Buddha's death. And there was a series of them to kind of systematize the teaching and to bring things together. And this one was to sort of confront some unorthodox views. And during this council, some monks were forced to return to lay life. In other words, kicked out. And it was the first intervention of state power into a Buddhist community, you know, which shows that I think, you know, Ashoka may have established some bad precedents, too. So he did a lot to propagate Buddhism. And I think the mixture of religion and government may give us pause here, but it should be pointed out that he also supported all other religions, too. And he encouraged tolerance, and he did not oppose any religion. And in another edict, he said, "If you condemn other religions, you harm your own. So concord is good. Let all be willing to listen to the doctrines professed by others." So, I referred to his edicts, and these were carved messages he left throughout the land. He put them on pillars and rocks and in caves. They're the earliest written records that survive in India, and they tell us a lot about Indian history. And 33 of them still exist today, a few pillars, a few rock inscriptions. You can go and see them. It seems like they're a little like the propaganda posters you would see all over the Soviet Union in the old days, except instead of telling people to support the state or trying to glorify his own rule, he's urging people to be good. And that's what they were about. The Dharma, I mean, he was setting forth the Dharma in all these edicts, and it wasn't, he didn't talk about the Four Noble Truths, he didn't explain Buddhist doctrine, he didn't go into a lot of detail, he just talked about the ethical teachings of the Buddha, promoting peacefulness, piety, religious tolerance, zeal, respect for parents and teachers, courtesy, charity, sense control, and equanimity. I'll quote from one of the pillars. There's one source that says the edicts, quote, can claim little literary merit, for their style is crabbed and often ambiguous. But I read some, and I thought they sounded pretty good. One says that people should conduct not superstitious rites, but kindness to servants and underlings, respect for those deserving respect, self-control coupled with kindness in dealing with living creatures. These and virtuous deeds of like nature are verily the rites that are everywhere to be performed. Sure. He says that people should conduct not superstitious rites, but kindness to servants and underlings, respect for those deserving respect, self-control coupled with kindness in dealing with living creatures. These and virtuous deeds of like nature are verily the rites that are everywhere to be performed. So, if I could return to Rahula a bit, he writes this nice paragraph about Buddhism and society. Buddhism aims at creating a society where the ruinous struggle for power is renounced, where calm and peace prevail away from conquest and defeat, where the persecution of the innocent is vehemently denounced, where one who conquers oneself is more respected than those who conquer millions by military and economic warfare. where hatred is conquered by kindness, and evil by goodness, where enmity, jealousy, ill will, and greed do not infect people's minds, where compassion is the driving force of action, where all, including the least of living things, are treated with fairness, consideration, and love, where life in peace and harmony, in a world of material contentment, is directed toward the highest and noblest aim, the realization of the ultimate truth, nirvana. So, that's a little bit about Ashoka, a little bit about the Buddhist view of what the Chakravartin ideal is, about how Buddhists might look at governance. And I think what it all comes down to is ruling kindly and skillfully. That's really all it is. And this is no surprise, given what Buddhism, given the nature of Buddhist practice and what the practice brings out in us. We all have a great deal of kindness, even in this very busy and distracted and sometimes angry world. But it's when we engage in meditation, I think, when we do this regularly and when we come here and we join with other people, with this really sweet, quiet group of people, that our kindness really blossoms. And we see how things are interrelated. All things are interrelated. We learn that from the teachings. But also through extensive sitting, if we keep at this practice for a long time, that interrelatedness is something we feel kind of deep in our bones, maybe beyond our bones. It's something beyond words. It's a lowering of the barriers between us and other things. There's this perceived division between you and me, between me and the objects in this room and the rest of the universe. And in a sense, there is no division there. And when we engage in extensive meditation, we can open up to that. And when we feel that, when we really feel deep in our bones that there's no division between ourselves and the outside world, what is there to do but act kindly toward all? If I would never hurt myself on purpose, how could I hurt you on purpose? If we're really the same. And if we feel this, that we really want to be kind to all beings, it's perfectly natural, perfectly in harmony with the universe, to try to be skillful in all things, to try to develop our skillfulness, lessen our distractions, so that we can do the most good with the resources we have. So, regardless of what you think about Ashoka as a leader, and he was certainly not perfect, or what you think about any specific leader today, or what your political beliefs might be, I think you might agree that the Chakravartin ideal and the 10 duties of the king as set forth by the Buddha, such as honesty and integrity, kindness and gentleness, freedom from hatred and ill will, are useful guidelines for our own behavior and also for choosing our leaders. I think, and one thing is certain, integrity is so important in our leaders. I mean, it seems really simple, really obvious, and really indisputable. But I think, you know, looking back on my own thoughts about political leadership, I think there may have been times when I've been a little bit willing to overlook ethical lapses on the part of people I agree with more than I've overlooked ethical lapses on the part of people I disagree with. And that's something I'm really looking at, you know. I think that we need to ask ourselves when looking at the people who are going to lead us, why are they doing this? What is their motivation? Do they follow a bodhisattva ideal? How do they lead their own lives? And I think we don't always want to think about the larger world. because there are so many problems. There are so many problems right now on so many fronts. There are times when we just want to kind of block it all out. You know, we kind of see this as an area of stress and fear. But I think it's perfectly appropriate for people who engage in Buddhist practice to really pay attention to this stuff, to really take the responsibility of choosing leaders seriously and to hold them accountable, to take that really seriously. I'm talking about engagement in the world. I think there's a common misperception, I think, especially among people who don't know much about Buddhism, about the practice of Buddhism, that Buddhists want to separate themselves from the world and simply enjoy bliss. That's sort of getting to a place where you feel really good all the time is what this is about, and you might go off in a cave somewhere and do this. But this is not true, because we have the ideal of the bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism. The bodhisattva, a highly advanced spiritual being who could just leave this world and do nothing but enjoy bliss, but chooses not to, chooses to stay behind in order to help all other creatures attain bliss. A person, a being who will not leave this world until that happens. Rahula says that the common belief that to follow the Buddhist teaching one has to retire from life is a misconception. It's really an unconscious defense against practicing it, he says. I thought that line was really interesting, that this belief that you have to go off somewhere and be by yourself or you can't practice is an unconscious defense against practicing. And it might be true. Maybe we say, you know, I don't have time to meditate today, so I can't really do my practice. When I have time to meditate, then I'll take up my practice. Or I'll start practicing seriously as soon as things settle down at my job, or as soon as I finish school this year, or something like that, then I'll get started. But that's not true. You can get started now. You can get started at work. You can get started while you're really busy with your class or whatever. It's just harder. That's all. It's a lot harder. Rahula also says it may be agreeable for some people to lead a retired life, but it's more praiseworthy and courageous to live among your fellow beings, being of service to them. If a person lives all his life in solitude, thinking of his or her own happiness and salvation, without caring for others, this surely is not in keeping with the Buddhist teaching, which is based on love, compassion, and service to others. And, of course, separation from the world is an important part of this practice. I mean, through solitude, through retreats, monastic life. This is really important, but it's only part of the picture. It's true that we separate ourselves sometimes from the world by coming here to this little island. This is an island in a way, an island of sort of peace and calm where things are ordered and we can eliminate distractions. But this is a place for coming to see how things are, see how things really are by eliminating all those distractions, to see what things hang us up, to see what things make us really glorious, open beings, ready to deal with anything that might come our way, and a place to cultivate those things that make us open, and to work on the things that make us want to close down, or run away, or give up. And so here, in meditation and in repeated ritual, we can see what the things are that make us want to cringe. We look at it again and again. We find those little moments of indecision. We learn to get past them. We find our hang-ups lifting, leaving us free, and we're ready to face the world and do what might scare us a little bit, whether that's home repair, or public speaking, or whatever. And we take it out into the real world. And I think that's a special strength of this center, because we're exploring ways here of having a really rich, active spiritual life while still being in the world. Even our abbot here has a full-time job. Being in the world does not interfere with our practice. being in the world is our practice. And we take our practice into our interactions with our families, to work. It's in the way we do our work, the way we keep our home. It's all practice. We take care of the things that need to be taken care of so we're not a problem for others, so we're strong enough and independent to help others. And that care extends to looking not just at the people in our family or people in our sangha or our circle of friends. Standing up in the moment means not ignoring any of it. We look at things on the micro level. We look at things that we're doing. If we're throwing away a plastic bag, we're aware that we're throwing away a plastic bag. We're concerned about what kind of light bulbs we're using, that kind of thing. On the other hand, we also need to look at these things at a macro level, which includes looking at how our society is structured, looking at who is getting the resources, looking at which groups in our society are suffering and why. It's our responsibility to pay attention. It's an important and not always easy part of our practice. It's part of standing up in the moment. And it's not always easy. We know about that part. Something I really liked about the inaugural address was what President Obama said about personal responsibility. So I would just like to end with some of his words at the very end of his speech, which I thought I thought this was really well said. He said, "With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter, and with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations." So, thanks for listening to me today, and thanks for coming to Zen Center. And if anyone has any comments or questions, I'd love to hear them. Yes?
If you were to run for president, I would vote for you. I know for a fact you would not win. Just my waste of wisdom and reason would never be heard in our culture. I think the game of politics is set up is that you have to have deals.
Mm-hmm.
You have to tell half truths, you have to tell lies, you have to obscure the truth. And it's a little dysfunctional political process. In general, not because of the wrong election or anything,
mm-hmm.
in general. Because I think to get wise leaders, we have to have wise voters.
Yeah, thanks, Will. Oh, that's a really interesting point. And I think it's true. Could a person go into politics and still always have the highest moral character, given the kind of deals one has to make? And that's the kind of problem I think we see in many areas of our lives. We kind of go into something and it's messy and we can't be as pure as we'd like to be. But I don't think we can let that sort of be an excuse for non-engagement, And I think we need really good people in governance. And I'm afraid that, making deals is part of what goes on. But it's an imperfect system. And I guess the question is it our responsibility to engage in it even though it's imperfect? Or would it be better for us to just stay away from it entirely? And I think, the world is often complicated, difficult, and messy. And we kind of have to sometimes embrace the mess, while doing our best to make it less messy, to make it more possible to do good through these systems that have been set up.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. That would be a nightmare.
It just seems like a macro version of what we have to deal with just in our own individual lives. I think we all have to navigate deals and not necessarily doing things exactly in what we would think is the most upright way, but sometimes to just do things, it just seems like we all have to make compromises to be able to live with each other.
Yeah, and well said.
And so it just seems like just trying to figure out how much to compromise and let go of our own points of view to be able to do something for the greater good in some way. It just gets magnified.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you talking to me.
Oh, thank you.
Nice to relate to current events.
Yeah, a little variety. Yes?
On the list of the attributes that Rahula listing the Buddhist attributes, there's a thing in here as a critical intelligence.
No, that's not in there.
Why?
Yeah, why would that
happen?
Sure. Let me.
Is that just natural selection?
Let me repeat that for the tape. The comment was that there wasn't anything in this list of 10 duties of the king about critical intelligence and what's going on there. And it's true. It doesn't say anything about that. That's a good one to add in, I think.
Do you think that was an omission, or do you think that was intentional? It seems like it would be one of the first attributes you really want to have a leader to have.
Right.
So it's really kind of a...
Okay, sure. First is not enriching self. Second, high moral character. Third, give up personal comfort. Four, honesty and integrity. Five, kindness and gentleness. Six, austerity in habits. Seven, freedom from hatred. Eight, nonviolence. Nine, patience. And 10, ruling in harmony with the people. What strikes me about these is these seem to be characteristics rather than skills. Duties. It's true. Yeah, duties also. So it doesn't really say anything about knowledge about government, intelligence, and things like that.
So,
right, and how to deal with that. You know, these are sort of the attributes, the qualities someone should have. And then I think we could have a whole second list of skills, of those kinds of qualities.
That's what you're saying, but is that what the attributes? I mean, is there a reason why it's not there? Is it just because if you didn't have that, you wouldn't be a politician?
This is a king, not an elected
official. Or being a good person enough.
Yeah.
Right.
They're also called duties. These are things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
They're more behaviors than attributes.
Mm-hmm. These also seem like precepts almost, they're modifications of precepts, and there's nothing in the precepts about you need to be intelligent.
I'm proof of that.
I think critical intelligence is considered discriminatory knowledge in some sense, and that's not very high up on the Eastern philosophical thought. They kind of eschewed this whole intellectual knowledge type thing. It's very, it seems natural for the Buddha not to include critical intelligence. Because that brings in a whole bunch of other things. He never talks about it, even in his other stuff. I mean, one thing to sort of, sense things and, in a non-discriminatory way, do things, which he can sort of flow into. But I don't know. That's just my feeling. I don't think it's an omission. I think
this is a kind of intelligence.
Right, in a different way. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, thanks again for coming to Zen Center today, and good discussion. And hope you'll stick around for a little conversation, some snacks, some coffee or tea maybe. So, thank you.